From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonida Inge.
And I'm Jeff Tiberi.
Well, Jeff, it's that time of year when those slithery serpents on the ground, snakes, they come out in North Carolina.
Oh, they're so cuddly, aren't they? No. Those friendly snakes. They do sometimes get a bad rap, and we're going to talk about all things snake today, the good and the bad.
Well, that's right. Later in the show, you'll talk with an emergency medicine doctor who's an expert on snake bite care and will give some really clear instructions on what to do and what not to do if you're one of the hundreds of people in North Carolina who gets bitten by a venomous snake each year.
But first, we're going to check in with a conversation Leonida had with someone who just loves snakes in the wild and also knows how to appreciate them from afar. Jeff Hall is a reptile conservation biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission.
You know, I just want to get this out of the way from the top. I really do not like snakes except for rattlesnakes because that's my college mascot. But I don't like live rattlesnakes, just the kind on my t-shirts and my earrings and, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. So I must ask you, do you actually like snakes or do you just know a lot about them?
You know what? I don't really like snakes. I love snakes.
Yeah!
Everything about them. They're just fascinating, amazing animals to me. And, you know, much like you, there are many people who aren't so sure what they think of the quote-unquote no-shoulders critters in the world. But, you know, maybe we can educate a little bit and learn that those live, awesome snakes out there on the landscape are pretty cool, too, not just on a t-shirt.
Well, I think they're pretty, and I love looking at snakes, but they do scare me a little. So what were, your first encounters with snakes as a kid? You know, what do you remember?
Yeah, you know, one of the very first early encounters I remember with a snake, I grew up in Raleigh. And in my backyard, there was a garter snake. At the time, I did not know that's what it was, but it was a garter snake, and it was trying to swallow a toad.
Oh, my.
And it was trying to swallow it from the rear so that I could see the toad's head sticking out of the snake's mouth.
Oh.
I know. And, you know, I was both horrified, fascinated, you know, just glued to the spot watching what was happening. And I didn't know, am I cheering for the toad? Am I cheering for the garter snake? And in the end, I just sort of jumped up and down and tried to make commotion, right? And the snake released the toad. The toad hopped away, and the garter snake slithered off and didn't quite get a meal out of it. Later on, I would realize that toad may not have survived that encounter.
Oh, no.
Because garter snakes and some other snakes have ways to immobilize their prey. And so that may have already started happening with that toad. But I was fascinated right then and there. I was like, this is my critter group. I don't remember how old I was, but I was very little.
Well, I'm not totally creeped out. I'm kind of excited too, you know? That was pretty exciting. What a memory. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions about snakes that you find people have in their minds?
Yeah, probably the number one is they're out to get us. They want to get you. You know, you're out walking a trail and you see a snake and you think it's going to attack you or come after you in some shape, way, or fashion. That's probably the number one thing that people think that really isn't the case. Snakes want to be left alone. They want to do their thing. You know, to them, we look like a giant predator. And although we might be afraid, some of course I'm not, but many people might be afraid when they see a snake, that snake is way more afraid of us than we are of it. That might be hard for some people to believe.
Very hard.
But that's definitely the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hear that all the time. They're more afraid of you than you are of them, you know.
Well, you know, think about this. So a snake, you know, a lot of times we think about how long they are, you know, maybe 2 feet, 3 feet, whatever the species, but they're only about an inch high. So think about how tall we are. I'm about 6'4", so somewhere around 76 inches tall. So I'm 76 times taller than that little snake is. You just imagine if I walk out in the parking lot here and something is 76 times taller than me, I am going to be scared out of my mind, right? So that's how that snake feels when we see it out in nature.
But Jeff, I'm not totally sold on what you're saying. Just
I can tell. I can
just
tell.
Just yet, but, you know, we're getting toward the middle of spring. Is this when snakes come out the most? You know, do they, like, hibernate?
Yeah. So, you know, snakes, like all of our reptiles, are ectothermic, or sometimes we use the word cold-blooded. And that means that they're the same temperature that the air is. They need external sources to warm their bodies. So in the wintertime, they have to disappear. Otherwise, they'll become snakesicles if we get below freezing temperatures. So they have to find somewhere that stays above that freezing temperature. Well, right about now, really about the middle of March, many years, when we start getting temperatures that are daily, you know, in the 60s, that's when most snakes start to emerge from their hibernation sites where they've been spending the winter and start doing other things in their lives where they need to get food and seek water, eventually shelter, at some point a mate, all these things that snakes have to do, to, just like every species of wildlife.
So now I just want to talk about the snakes that live in North Carolina.
Sure. Yeah, we have 38 species that call North Carolina home, so we're really lucky, the diversity of snakes that are out there on the landscape. And as you might imagine, with that array of different species, they use many different habitat types. So just about every natural habitat type that you can find in North Carolina has at least one species that might call that home. So lots of places that would potentially have snakes.
Wow, I'm here with Jeff Hall, a reptile conservation biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. We're going to dig in deep on snakes after this break, including copperheads, right? And then later in the show, an emergency medicine doctor talks about how to treat snake bites, how often they happen, and improvements coming down the line to make anti-venom more accessible and cheaper. I'm Leonida Inge. You're listening to Due South. You better stay away from Copperhead Road. Welcome back to Due South. I'm Leonida Inge. Back to my conversation with Jeff Hall, a reptile conservation biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. I know you're in Greenville, North Carolina, out east. I'm in Durham, North Carolina. So, of course, I want to know, are there any snakes that are specific to the Triangle area?
Sure. Yeah, there's at least 20 species that call the Triangle home. So, you know, many of the backyard common snakes that people see would include the northern brown snake, or also called the decay snake, the worm snake, and the rough earth snake, and the smooth earth snake. Now, all four of those species are little snakes. We're not talking any bigger than maybe 8 to 10 inches long as adults. So many people, when they see these in their yard or, you know, in their gardens, they think, oh, this is a baby snake, when in fact, those are actually adults of those species.
Are they venomous?
But those are relatively common.
Are they venomous?
All those are non-venomous.
Okay, thank you. I needed to know that really quick.
Yes.
Really fast.
Yes. So we have, of our 38 species, we have 6 species in the state that are venomous, but only one that's found across most of the state, and that's the copperhead. That one is definitely found in the Triangle area. Most of the rest of them are principally coastal plain in distribution, although timber rattlesnakes, one of our 6 venomous species, is also widely found in the mountains and a few little places in the Piedmont.
So why do we know so much about the copperhead snake? And I thought they can be found like in all 100 of our counties, can't they?
Yeah, you know, the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences keep records of every species and every county that they've been seen in. And actually, we don't have a verifiable record of every county, but we presume they're in every county. I think there's maybe 4 or 5 counties where we don't actually have a record, but I'm sure they're there. So yeah, they occur all across the state. They're very able to use different habitat types, so they can eat a lot of different types of foods. Everything from cicada larvae and caterpillars to small rodents to salamanders to other snakes. So they really have a varied diet and can eat a lot of different things and live in a lot of different places.
They can eat anything. That's what it sounds like to me.
Anything that's roughly the size category that they want to be able to eat. Yes. Well, they're not going to eat your poodle or, you know, your cat or anything like that.
Oh, that's good to know. And I think of the copperhead. Describe what it looks like. I think that's one reason I guess children definitely love, even say, it's pretty to me. I think it's pretty.
Oh, yeah. You know, many snake species are beautiful, and copperhead is maybe more beautiful than any of the others, really, if you get away from your fear and really look at those colors. So you have a light tan background with darker tan bands that cross the snake. Those bands are wider at the side and narrower at the top. And so what it ends up looking like from above is like an hourglass pattern. If you look at it from the side, I've heard some people describe it as a row of Hershey's Kisses along the side there. So if you can sort of envision that, that's what a copperhead looks like.
Yeah, when you see that Hershey Kiss pattern, you know what it is.
Yes, that's right. And actually, as juveniles, for about the first maybe 18 months of life, they have a brightly colored tail tip. It'll be a bright green or bright yellow. They actually use that. This is really cool. They use that as a lure to bring in small lizards, salamanders, things like that. They'll actually wiggle that out in front of their head and bring things in as a lure. So pretty neat. But that lasts for about 18 months, and then it sort of changes color to match the rest of the body.
I have to ask, are there any rattlesnakes in North Carolina?
There are. We have three species. Yep. We have, as I mentioned, the timber rattlesnake. We also have the pygmy rattlesnake and the eastern diamondback rattlesnake.
Oh, yeah. That's the one that I think I've even drawn as a child, the diamondback.
That's one that's maybe the easiest to draw, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put some diamonds down the back and you got it. Unfortunately for us, snake lovers, the diamondback is probably the most rare snake in our state now. It used to occur in about 13 counties, but now it's only found in about one. So some of our snakes aren't doing quite as well as some of the others.
You know, I remember hearing about like a rhyme telling the way to remember which red and yellow and black snakes are poisonous. But I always mix that up. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do entirely. So you're thinking of the eastern coral snake, which is a venomous species. And then we have two lookalikes to some degree, the scarlet snake and the scarlet king snake. So both have scarlet in their name, but they're both look a little bit similar. Both of them have red, black, and white or red, black, and yellow rings. And the rhyme you're thinking of is red and yellow, kill a fellow, red and black, friend of Jack. And what happens is people forget that rhyme or they get adrenaline pumping and they go, I don't know, red and black kill you dead.
No.
I don't know. I don't remember. So what I usually go with is if you're of driving age, you're driving down the road, the light is green, then it turns to yellow. What happens next? It turns to?
Red.
And what do you do?
Stop.
So if you see yellow turn to red, you stop. That's all you have to think of. That way, you'll always remember that red and yellow together is not one you want to pick up.
Wow.
Easy, right?
I guess it's easy. Yes, I'm going to remember that.
So what a little easier than the rhyme.
I know. What about the snakes that are on land versus snakes in the water?
Some species do tend to favor areas that have aquatic systems or wetlands, like some of our water snakes. Sometimes garter snakes are found around water, ribbon snakes. But all of our snakes in North Carolina have the ability to swim. And so water is not necessarily a barrier to our species. But we have some that might be found more often in uplands or what we would say is dry systems, and others that might be more commonly found in wetland systems.
When we think about snake behavior, you know, how we want to be safe, but we want the snakes to be safe as well.
Sure. You know, it's really easy to remain unbitten, right? So I'm a herpetologist. I work with snakes all the time. I go and look for snakes. I have never been bitten by a venomous snake. Why is that? Because I'm really good at observing my surroundings. Whenever I'm going into systems where I think there could be a snake here, I'm looking around, I'm paying attention, I'm not putting my feet or my hands anywhere that I cannot see, which is a good indication of where there could be something that could potentially bite me that I don't want to be bitten by. And like I mentioned earlier, snakes don't really want to come after us. They're not aggressive. They are defensive in nature. So if they feel threatened, that's when there's the potential for some sort of interaction. Most of the time, if people are bitten, it's because they aren't observing, they aren't seeing what's happening, they accidentally step on or accidentally touch the animal. That's kind of when most interactions tend to occur. So For most of our snakes, if you just sort of watch and see what they're doing, they're going to go on about their business. They're going to go away from you. They're going to leave you alone as long as you don't interact with them.
You know, we're about to have a lot of cicadas out and about real soon. I guess that's just a smorgasbord for snakes. I mean, that means they should have plenty to eat, right?
Well, especially copperheads.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, copperheads really love cicada larvae. So as those cicadas are emerging from the ground, crawling along, and then they get to a tree and they'll climb up a little bit, sometimes you'll even get this time of year or a little bit later when you get these large emergences of cicadas, you'll have congregations of maybe 2, 3, 4 copperheads around a tree that seems to be really good for cicadas, especially sort of late in the evening, right at that dusk time period, you know, up to 30 minutes after, they'll be hanging out and they'll be looking for those cicadas. A tasty treat for them, for whatever reason, that's really a preferred prey item.
Well, I'm so sorry. We have to go now, but I didn't ask you what's your favorite snake.
Oh, that's always the toughest question. You know, it's the one that I'm looking at right at the time. I love all the snakes. They're all really, really amazing. Different color patterns, things about them, what they eat, what they do. They're really just fascinating.
Well, Jeff Hall, thanks for being with me today and talking snakes.
It has been a pleasure, Leonida. I have had the most fun. Thank you so much.
Well, Jeff Hall is a reptile conservation biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. I'm Leonida Inge. This is Due South.
Now we need to shift gears a little bit to the not-so-good, bad side of snakes, the bites.
You know, we reached out to North Carolina Poison Control for some numbers. Last year in North Carolina, there were over 600 venomous snake bites reported to North Carolina Poison Control, the vast majority of which were copperheads.
And according to Dr. Michael Bueller, the medical director of NC Poison Control, when looking at national numbers, North Carolina accounts for more than 1 in 5 of all copperhead bites across the United States. So we brought in Dr. Charles Girardo, chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine and professor of emergency medicine and global health at Duke University, to ask him what someone should do if they get bit by a venomous snake.
In North Carolina, the first thing is stay calm. And probably the second thing to do is to seek medical care, which surprisingly doesn't always happen.
Hmm.
There's this element of denialism the moment you're bitten, like, that did not just happen. Maybe I'll just write it out. Maybe it's not that bad. Maybe it's not a venomous snake. And then sometimes symptoms progress and then people come in delayed.
How often do people get bit by snakes in North Carolina? Do you have data on it?
So it depends on the year, of course.
Yeah.
But hundreds of times, many of them go unreported. At Duke University Hospital, we see between 35 and 65 bites a year, and that's just a single, large but single hospital.
Okay.
That gives you any indication.
So several hundred bites across the state. You think it's north of 1,000 or probably not?
No, probably not north of 1,000. In the entire U.S., there's about 10,000 bites a year.
Total. Okay. So if this happens to me or somebody I know or care about or anybody listening, you should stay calm, which means you should not start acting hysterically. What else should you not do?
Almost everything that you've ever heard about. So don't cut the wound. Don't suck the wound. There's no need to apply a suction device. All those things do more harm than good. Even something as simple as applying ice is actually not beneficial and potentially
harmful. Because it's bad for the tissue or why? Harmful.
Well, the theory behind one, ice helps a lot of injuries and helps with inflammation. And the kind of thought was that since the venom are mostly proteins, that it would kind of slow down the activity of the protein. But it also inhibits your ability to respond to the bite. So they've done some pretty elaborate animal models that show that it doesn't work well and causes harm, worsens the wound, for example.
What happens in the body when someone gets bit by a copperhead or another kind of snake?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the first thing to describe that is to start with the venom itself. So the venom, snake venom, is very complex. It's not simple like a scorpion venom or bee venom. It's very complex. Most pit vipers, which is the most common envenomating snake in the U.S., has like 50-plus biologically active toxins. So it's extremely complex, which means that the human response is also very complex. But the simplest way to describe it is just think of the venom going into the tissue, and then that initiates an inflammatory firestorm in your body, and it can affect all sorts of different systems. So it can cause tissue damage, but can also cause things like shock, and it's most severe, it can cause shock. Mm-hmm. It can cause other symptoms like nausea and vomiting, shortness of breath, dizziness, passing out, all sorts of things, and it impacts your ability to clot blood.
So I guess I want to take two random subjects. I'll make me one, just a generic 40-year-old white guy in good health, versus somebody older with an underlying health condition, or one of my children, or somebody under the age of 10. Are certain groups of people, certain types of people, going to be impacted differently and more quickly?
Yes. One is generally every snake bite. You know, they always say, if you've seen one snake bite, you've seen one snake bite. Every snake bite is really different. It depends on the amount of venom that's injected. Even within a snake, it depends on what time of year it is and what, you know, what toxins are predominant in that snake. So it's a really variable disease. But if you look at, you know, hundreds, thousands of people, people that are at the greatest risk are at the extremes of age, or those that are unhealthy. So little kids, you could imagine if a child got the same amount of venom injected that you did as a grown man, they would have a much more severe envenomation. Yeah. Also, someone who's elderly, for example, or has underlying medical problems is likely to do worse. And that's been fairly well studied.
Quick fact check here. It's more dangerous to get bit by a baby copperhead than a full-grown copperhead.
That is very common mythology that is not true. You know, I have seen very severe bites from baby snakes, and dry bites, so no symptoms, from full-grown adult snakes. But if you take all comers, there's something that we know, that the larger the snake, an adult snake, causes, on average, worse problems.
How does a snake bite turn fatal, and with what prevalence does that happen?
Yeah. So in the U.S., fatal snake bites are not common. Like I said, there's about 10,000 bites a year, and there's 5 to 10 deaths per year. And the predominant envenomating snake we have in North Carolina, it is the copperhead. And death from copperhead happens, but is exceedingly rare. And that's one of the reasons I recommended staying calm initially, is because death from this is rare. Now, there's a lot of other things you don't want aside from death, like, you know, disability or missing work or what, you know, pain, all those other things are really what we're concerned about.
We return with Dr. Charles Girardo, chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine and professor of emergency medicine and global health at Duke University, after the break. I'm Jeff Tabiri. You're listening to Due South on WUNC. Welcome back to Due South on listener-supported WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri. It's the Snake Hour. Let's slither back into my conversation about venomous snake bites with Dr. Charles Girardo. The do's, the don'ts, and we were curious. What if you get bit, but there's no blood? How concerning is that?
Well, you have to get venom in the tissue to cause a problem. So obviously you have to have some damage to the skin, but we absolutely have seen significant envenomation from like a fang mark that just kind of glancing blow. We've absolutely seen that. So long as the skin is broken.
The skin is broken. Don't have to be bleeding. Okay. In this rare instance that somebody gets bitten by a snake, a venomous snake, urgent care, hospital, poison control, other choice?
That's a great question. Although I'm going to give a complex answer. I think the short answer is go to an emergency department. The reason why I feel that that is the right choice is as follows. One is you need an expert to assess whether you actually have symptoms or not, and how bad it is. And that can happen at multiple sites. Mm-hmm. But if you meet the threshold for treatment, which is a fairly low bar to offer treatment, that's only going to be able to be administered in an emergency department initially, and then in a hospital.
I appreciate on the front end you just being willing to go with my throwaways, but I'm going to set a little bit of a picture here for you. at my house at night, sometimes after the kids go out, I will go outside and I'll shoot baskets at times. And I make, of course, lots of baskets, but I'll also airball a basket or something will shank off the rim and go into the yard. And the lights only cover so much. And we do have snakes at my house. We have what I think are black snakes or rat snakes. I have seen copperheads in the neighborhood, though not right around my basketball hoop. Let's just say, this has not happened to be clear, but let's just say for hypothetical sake that I get bit by a snake at night when I'm outside in these warmer months. But I don't see the snake. Like, I reach to get a ball behind the bush and ow, but I don't see it. What am I doing?
That's a great question. So, Jeff, when you're bitten, please just give me a call.
Okay.
But what does everyone else do?
Yeah, that would be
It almost doesn't matter what type of snake you're bitten from. So a non-venomous snake is not going to give you any symptoms of a venomous snake, right? So you're going to, sure, you might have the holes or the wound and a little bit of pain from the bite, but you're not going to get the swelling and the other signs and symptoms we see from a venomous snake bite. So I think if you have absolutely nothing, fine, you can sit on that. But if you start developing swelling or pain shooting up the arm or other symptoms like nausea, vomiting, lightheadedness, that certainly was a venomous snake and you should seek care.
Care. I want to chat about anti-venom. What is anti-venom and how rarely is it administered?
I'll describe what it is, but it is commonly administered. So anti-venoms have been around actually since the 19th century. In the 1890s, they started putting anti-venoms into human beings for different envenomations. And they've been marketable, I think, in the U.S. since like the 1920s. So anti-venoms are actually just antibodies. And they're made in large mammals. The current U.S. antivenoms that we have available are made in either horses or sheep.
Okay.
And what they do is the animal is injected with venom, not to the point that it kills them, but to the point that they begin to develop antibodies over time. And then that their serum or their blood is taken, it's purified. The antivenoms are extracted and purified, turned into a powder, and then, you know, that goes into the pharmacy shelves and they mix that with saline and then that's what they infuse into. So it's kind of like, think of it as almost like a transfusion.
A vaccine transfusion?
Well, very purified form of a transfusion part of the blood of a large mammal. So it's really a biologic is what they call it. Mm-hmm. It's not a single molecule. Like, you can't draw out the chemical structure of antivenom. It's multiple different antibodies. Yeah.
So I'm learning here. So anti-venom is commonly administered. How expensive is it?
That's a great question. It is, if you look at the charge, like what you see on the, like what the hospitals are charged, it's variable hospital, but it is expensive, more than you or I are going to want
like
to pay.
Like tens of thousands of dollars?
If you look at the whole dose, they can charge the hospital that much for the drug. However, my primary concern is what is the cost to the patient? And that is extremely variable. So over 3/4 of snake bites in North Carolina, the patients that are bitten by snakes have some sort of insurance coverage. And that's a study out of the Carolina's Poison Center. For those people, so let's say you have insurance that covers the cost. The cost to you is going to be relatively low. So you may see this gigantic charge of tens of thousands of dollars on a bill, but what the patient actually often pays can be low. Where it's really concerning is for people who are self-pay or don't have any coverage, and then they have a really difficult choice to make. So they got this thing that's going to keep them out of work and can potentially cause problems, which is a threat to their finances versus the actual what they're going to be billed with. So that's a difficult situation.
Dr. Charles Girardo is chair of Department of Emergency Medicine at Duke University, also professor of emergency medicine and global health. We're discussing venomous snake bites, what to do, what not to do, signs of real concern, and just the general landscape of how this plays out in North Carolina. How many snake bites have you treated over the years, roughly?
We're approaching 1,000. So I've been in North Carolina for 24 years, and I see within a year or two, I started seeing almost every snake bite that comes in. So if you do the math, 35 to 65 a year, it's probably approaching around 1,000 bites at this point.
You see every single one that comes in?
almost every single one. Sometimes I'm out of town.
Sometimes.
But I get called on every single one.
Interesting. Common themes? Is it gardening? Is it trail running? Is it, what is it?
It is not what you think. I think there's a mythology, which is mostly driven from snake bites out west. And I used to practice out west, so I used to see these kind of snake bites. It would be a young 20-year-old intoxicated man handling the snake. Actually, the average age of our snake bites in North Carolina is 40 years old. It's a pretty even distribution between men and women. What we often see is people doing yard work or, walking through leaf litter or something like that, or, taking a log for the fire and those kinds of things.
Almost 1,000. Have any of those patients died?
No.
No.
But we have had some that have tried really hard too.
How'd you save them?
Anti-venom and then supportive care. It takes a while to administer anti-venom.
Yeah.
It takes a while to mix it up because it comes in a powder and you can't just like shake it into solution because you'll denature the proteins. So it takes a while to mix it up and it takes about an hour to run in.
And it's administered through an IV?
Yeah, it has to be administered through an IV.
Interesting. Across those 1,000 patients that you've seen who have been bitten by snake bites across a couple decades here in North Carolina, who comes to mind first? What stories, what instances?
I think that aside from those that, are in shock and are severely ill in the moment, the things that really come to mind are those that either have had delayed care or a really bad bite and never fully recover, which is not the typical case, but absolutely does happen.
And what does that mean, not fully recovered? Have you had to amputate a foot or part of a leg? Is there there's permanent tissue damage? There's nerve damage?
Yeah, so amputation or surgery is rarely indicated. In that almost 1,000 patients, we literally have only had one patient that ever had to go to the operating room. So that is extremely rare. But what happens is you can get tissue damage that is either treated late or so bad by the time they get there that the antivenom's not, that we won't reverse tissue damage. It can only stop it from getting worse. And then they never fully recover. They, have an injury to a tendon or decreased mobility, or they always have pain at that site, or their sensation never fully comes back, those types of things.
In addition to being a professor and an emergency department physician, you are also a researcher. Tell us about your research and your efforts to find a pill to be part of this conversation.
Yes. Yeah. Antivenom has limitations. And one of the limitations are, we've already talked about, so it has to be administered IV. It also has to put, although U.S. antivenoms are very safe, worldwide antivenoms are not universally as safe as they are in the U.S. So when you administer it, you have to be able to deal with the potential adverse reactions. And the big complication you can get with antivenoms are allergic reactions, which can be severe and life-threatening themselves. So that is one of the limitations, is you need a medical expert to administer it. Because of that, although in Durham, someone may be bitten by a copperhead in their backyard, generally you don't have immediate access to care when someone is bitten by a snake, because often happens in either a more rural environment and worldwide. This is worldwide snake bite is
globally
a very
speaking,
big problem. So we will do some work in the Brazilian Amazon, for example, and it may take days to seek care.
There's no roads. The only way in or out is a small plane. If you could, just in our final moment or two, kind of paint the picture between what it's like elsewhere, and we know what it's like here, but in other parts of the world, how much of a problem is this and how hard is it to get to care?
So there's about 150,000 deaths per year globally, and over 400,000 cases of people who are permanently disabled. And this mostly happens in low resource areas of low and middle income countries, because snake bite is a tropical and subtropical disease. It's important to say that snake bite is a time-dependent illness. So the earlier you treat it, the better the outcomes. And that's for any treatment. So one of the strategies is to develop something that does not require the medical expertise that antivenom requires to give. And so one option is an oral pill. And currently that is, we've completed one trial of a potential therapeutic and undergoing a second trial of the same medication. But in addition to a novel therapeutic, distribution or decentralized distribution of therapies is actually another path to address the same issue. So ultimately, I think if you look at decreasing the burden of snake bite globally, it's going to take a multi-pronged approach, both of novel therapeutics, but also of decentralized distribution and the necessary information that would have to go along with that decentralized distribution.
Dr. Charles Girardo is chair, Department of Emergency Medicine at Duke University, also professor of emergency medicine and global health. Dr. Girardo, Chuck, thanks for joining us here on Due South.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Due South on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.